Hello, I'm Bill Barol in Santa Monica, California.
I'm Matt Ricardo in Southend, England.
How are you, Matt?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm average. Thank you for asking.
Okay.
This is Imagination and Junk, the transatlantic conversation about the hard work of creativity, except today it isn't really, because we're doing another one of our periodic, very special bonus episodes that we call I Might Be Wrong, But. And in each of those installments, one of us picks a piece of pop culture that we think is perhaps not as well appreciated as it might be, perhaps underrated, and tries to convince the other one that they should share their affection for it. And the other one rotely disagrees and the whole thing goes down in flames.
Yeah, that's certainly, I think, what's going to happen today.
Something to look forward to for all of us. In installment number 3 of I Might Be Wrong, But, it was Matt's choice. Today, I'm up, and the piece of culture that I am choosing to defend today is an old favorite of mine from 1982, directed by Mr. Ron Howard, the film Night Shift. There you go. The film was a modest critical success. You might be interested to know that Michael Keaton, whose film debut this was, won the coveted Kansas City Film Critics Circle Award for Best Supporting Actor.
I mean, I'm stunned.
Good night, everybody.
I mean, good for him. For me, he is the problem with this film.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because to me, he is exactly the thing. Well, he is the main thing that makes this movie watchable and fun and somewhat remarkable.
I think you're probably right, because that is the opinion of the world. The world loves this film. The world loves this film principally because Michael Keaton is Michael Keatoning all over the place, and it launched his career. And I think I'm the only person that just, oof.
One more fun fact about this movie before we jump into the synopsis. It was actually based on a true story. That's right. I've done research. I have gone to Wikipedia. In 1976, two city employees and a laborer were charged with operating a call girl ring out of a morgue, not just any morgue, but of course, the New York City morgue. A detective told the New York Times, it was a very well-run professional operation. So there you go.
Very nice characterization.
Thank you so much. That's my New York City detective character.
Very good.
I'll be at the Chuckle Hut next week. Shall we leap in?
Let's.
Okay. We begin in the pre-credits sequence with a place that somehow you just know is downtown Los Angeles subbing in for Times Square, New York City. We begin on a close shot of some pointy knee-high Italian leather boots, pan up to reveal a streetwalker. Once again, Matt, it's that old movie trope, footwear is destiny.
Footwear is destiny.
That's what they say, isn't it? Footwear is destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And the almost the second shot is we see a similar shot of red pointy cowboy boots, and we pan up to meet a pimp who we later find out is named Franklin Delano Roosevelt Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to convince you, Matt, to try to convince you that I'm not going to be blindly supportive of this movie, I will say the screenwriters could have pitched a little longer on the name.
I think it's fine. It's funny. It's, you know, I was going to say current, but that it's not current.
No. Franklin starts getting chased around downtown L.A., standing in for the Times Square area of New York by a couple of vicious bad guys, one of whom was played by the late Richard Belzer, who was then a stand-up comic dabbling in acting. Anyway, the three of them have a business dispute, and Franklin ends up getting chucked out a window.
He gets chucked out of a window while still tied to a chair.
Yeah, yeah. They did good work, Richard Belzer and anonymous tough guy number 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, efficient.
So, the late Franklin gets put in a hearse and driven through the nighttime New York City streets. These are the real New York City streets because obviously they had a second unit in New York. To the tune of Quarter Flash's Night Shift.
Frankie, out on the street, working late again.
Pure, uncut essence of 1980s.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing I will say about Night Shift and the other songs in this movie is that they were written by Carol Bayer Sager and Burt Bacharach. So, if you were looking for music that definitively said, this is 1982, they got their money's worth it.
On the night shift,
Quarter Flash, known to me only for the song Harden Your Heart.
Correct.
Which I got as a child on the TV advertised compilation cassette American Heartbeat.
I had that cassette too, although over here it was just called Heartbeat.
I noticed the music was by Burt Bacharach. In my notes, I have a score so notable that it's not mentioned on his Wikipedia.
It was not a high point. Let's put it that way. It was not a high point in the Burt Bacharach oeuvre.
Yeah. It's not played at the Burt Bacharach tribute concerts.
No.
No.
We should pause at this point to acknowledge the writers. Yes, there were writers on this thing, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys were the kings of big and small screen comedy in the early 80s, Lowell Gantz and Babalu Mandel, who together or individually would write loads of comedy in the 70s and 80s, including Splash and City Slickers and Parenthood, A League of Their Own, and for TV, The Odd Couple and Happy Days. And to prove that they weren't just one-trick ponies, Matt, that they had range and depth, both Laverne and Shirley and Joni Loves Chachi.
Oh, boy, oh, boy.
Yeah.
I mean, good for them. Babaloo's not a name. It's not even a word. Babaloo's the noise a office chair makes when you sit down on it too quick.
Well done.
Thank you.
I enjoyed that very much. We move along to the morgue, in which we meet two of our three leads. Shelley Long, who that same year, 1982, would start her role on a plucky little sitcom called Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry Winkler. Shelley Long playing a character named Belinda Keaton, and Winkler playing morgue attendant Chuck Lumley. Winkler was around this time the biggest star in TV sitcoms. He had made a few years before a theatrical feature, his debut called Heroes with Sally Field, and he'd also made The One and Only, directed by Carl Reiner in 1978. This movie from 1982 seems like much more a calculated attempt than either of those to put some distance between himself and the Fonz. Chuck is pretty much the polar opposite of the Fonz. He is a shy, squeaky little milquetoast. Is that a fair characterization?
It absolutely is. And there is a story behind this. Are you aware of the story behind why he's playing this part?
No.
I did some research. I listened to some podcasts. There are other podcasts.
Ooh.
It doesn't seem fair. Ron Howard had left Happy Days, got some funding to make this movie. The studio had seen the script, seen that there was a sort of quiet, nerdy guy and a wild and crazy guy, and had said, we'll give you the budget if you can sign Henry Winkler, the Fonz. Clearly wanting and assuming Henry Winkler, the Fonz, would be the wild and crazy guy. So Henry Winkler said, yeah, I'll do it, but I want to play, in his own words, I want to play Richie.
Bait and switch, buddy.
Bait and switch.
Yeah, yeah.
I have here in my notes, Shelley Long, typecast once again as a tough New York streetwalker. Come on!
She was adorable in this.
I guess. She's fine. She's fine. A role so notable that it's not mentioned in her Wikipedia.
Ouch. Ouch. I will say this much, though, for 1982 Henry Winkler. I hope we can agree on this. In 1982, Henry Winkler was a snack.
A lovely voice.
And Belinda, for her part, Belinda's got spunk. She's got spunk. This scene at the morgue actually has two of my favorite lines in the whole movie. One comes when the cop who's there asks Belinda what her relationship was to Franklin, and she glares at him and says icily,
he was my Avon lady.
Strong.
Yeah, I okay. Mean, grudging?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when the cop pushes back,
oh, give me a break.
Well, give me a break. You think this is a thrilling morning for me? Huh? Eat an Egg McMuffin, look at a dead guy.
I maintain that this is funny.
It's not, yeah.
Wow, you really hate this thing. And Michael Keaton hasn't even appeared yet. That's how much you hate this movie.
I'm starting to feel really bad about my opinions on this film.
It's all I ask, my friend. Also in this scene, another one of my favorite lines, Belinda tells Chuck that Franklin once told her he wanted to be buried in his car. And Chuck says in this sort of innocently baffled way,
we don't do that.
Oh.
You'd probably have to call the funeral home or the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah, that was a good gag. That was a good line. I'll give you that.
Thank you very much. We start laying in story now, Matt. The screenwriters aren't just riffing here. They're laying down story beats.
Babalu takes his shit seriously, except his name. He doesn't take his name seriously.
Belinda is pretty sure she knows Chuck from somewhere, but she and we as the audience don't know where at this point, and he's absolutely mortified. Okay, so the shift is over, and Chuck's supervisor, Mr. Carbone, tells him he's getting bumped to nights to make room for his nephew. Chuck, being a milquetoast, offers the tiniest little hint of protest, and then he backs right down.
Yeah, he's a Richie. He's not a Fonz.
We cut to a scene with Chuck and his fiancée, Charlotte, and we establish that she has an utter phobia of fat. She is an average-sized person who is convinced that she's fat. She's constantly trying to lose weight.
I have in my notes, this poor broken woman, clearly living with depression and severe mental illness, desperately needs help rather than a boyfriend who is just trying to patch up her brain so that he can have sex with her. It's not nice. This poor woman.
Well, now I just feel bad.
For me, this was the only sympathetic character in the entire movie.
Chuck arrives home, his evening with Charlotte having gone off the rails, gets chased to his door by a vicious dog in his hallway, like every other day. That becomes a running gag through the movie. The dog, we will see again.
Yes.
We see Chuck commuting in the subway for his first night shift. There are, I will maintain in this sequence, some nice imaginative sight gags of Chuck swimming upstream like a salmon because he's on nights and the whole world is on days. He gets bullied into insensibility by these vicious crowds of New Yorkers because you got to remember, New York City in 1982 was a comedy hellscape.
Yes, the him going down the stairs and then being brought back up by a crowd of people is, I'm going to become a cineast now, just for about 8 seconds, so buckle up. Reminds me of the opening sequence of Jacques Tati's excellent Monsieur Hulot's Holiday.
Chuck arrives at work for his first night on the titular night shift, and there was a sight gag in here that you sort of enjoyed, I believe, right?
This is my favorite gag in the movie. It's not a laugh-out-loud gut-ripper of a gag, but it's a lovely character piece. He goes to his office, and the first thing he does is he goes to his locker, unlocks it, and takes out his houseplant and puts it on his desk. Lovely. That's lovely. It's him keeping his personality in locked up, and oh, it's lovely. It's all downhill from there.
And right on time, cue the second act. Here comes Michael Keaton as Chuck's new partner.
How you doing? I'm Bill Blazejowski. You call me Billy Blaze. You must be Chuck, right? Nice shoes.
Keaton blows into this movie like a hurricane. He's all unfocused energy. He tells Chuck that he's an idea man, but clearly what he is an unfocused fuck-up. If he isn't explicitly a cokehead, and the movie never says he is, he, for all practical purposes, he might as well be. Keaton was making his big theatrical debut here. He had been in TV since 1974. And his first credit, according to IMDb, was as Black and White Panda on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. You probably remember Black and White Panda.
It's one of my favorite pandas. It's interesting because it feels like they wanted Robin Williams. I know Keaton did stand-up, but I don't think he did Robin Williams-style stand-up. And I think it's interesting because the film we just talked about, Real Genius, the Val Kilmer character is broadly similar. But for me, Val Kilmer is a sympathetic character. I felt drawn to Val Kilmer. With Michael Keaton, he was doing all that was required, and this launched him to a huge career. This was his breakout role, so clearly the world thought he was amazing. I just found him repellent. I found him absolutely unlikable, which means that all of his crazy is annoying. You know, we've all met people who are like that, who, if you like them, their crazy is endearing and brilliant and funny. If you don't like them, their crazy is just shut up.
The character is exhausting. We can agree on that. I think that's by design, and I think it's redeemed by a couple of moments that are coming later in which Keaton plays it straight and much more real and does it well and gives the character some bottom and some gravity. For me, it worked. The story value we get here is that Chuck explains to Bill that the supervisor isn't around at night and it'll just be them. Chuck gives Bill a quick tour of the morgue, which ends with Bill pointing into an open morgue drawer and exclaiming as if he just realized the whole thing for the first time,
"That guy's dead!"
Made me laugh.
I was curious about the idea of, in movies, it's one of the classic tropes. I mean, what films are a Lethal Weapon? There you go. The film that starts with you're breaking in a new partner. He's crazy!
Right.
Do morgue attendants have partners?
Well, if you're looking for this film to be a primer on the day-to-day realities of working in a morgue, I'm going to suggest that it's perhaps not that.
Okay, I'm sorry. Once again, I've grasped for too much.
We have another beat of Chuck and Charlotte trying unsuccessfully to have sex. She's too much of a mess because, as Matt has established, she is a sympathetic character. Mm-hmm. At this point...
Chuck.
You're not fat.
That music.
What music?
That music.
Music starts playing from next door. They can hear it through the wall. Now, a point of personal privilege, if I may. In 1982, I was in fact living in New York. I had a woman who lived next door to me on 69th Street, my studio apartment at 69th and Columbus. She would come home every night at about 2 a.m. and start playing Rio by Duran Duran. That was the soundtrack of my life in the early 80s.
Except it sounded like this.
And this was when you were working as a pimp?
Correct.
Right.
So Chuck goes next door to complain, and hey, it's the movies. It's Belinda's apartment. Yeah, okay. Fair point, or fair play, as I believe you say over there. And Belinda is having a date with a gigantic rodeo cowboy, wearing only a cowboy hat and white underwear, which leads to what may be my favorite exchange in the entire movie. Belinda says, "Don't worry, I hardly ever do business here." Charlotte has appeared magically fully dressed, and she says icily,
"What kind of business are they doing?"
And Chuck says,
She sells cowboy hats."
The man was in his underwear.
And cowboy underwear.
It's funny-ish.
Funny-ish. Charlotte has lost the mood and goes home, and Chuck, for good measure, gets terrorized by the vicious dog. One more time.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping alive the dog runner. It's the next night at work, at the morgue, sandwiches are delivered. Another running bit for this movie. Chuck's is wrong, as always. He waves it off because he doesn't want to bother the guy at the restaurant to make him another sandwich. We learn in here that he used to be a big-time financial advisor, but he had to give it up because there was too much pressure. He likes this job because it's quiet and there's no stress. Oh, not for long, Chuck. Not for long. A weird kid in a tuxedo shows up. Clint Howard sighting, Matt.
Clint Howard.
Clint Howard is Ron Howard's brother.
Ah!
Who he very loyally puts in, I think, every movie he's ever made. Clint Howard has had at least a small part in every movie Ron Howard has ever made.
Okay.
We find out that Bill is hiring out as a limo driver in the hearse during off hours in the morgue. Let me remind you, this actually happened.
Well, I mean, you know. So this is day two.
Yeah.
This is day two of them doing the night shift.
Ish.
Ish. And so did he already have a magnetic branded sign for limos? Because he sticks a magnetic branded sign on the side of the hearse. Did he get that made in less than a day in 1982 in that economy?
Yeah, he went to one of those 24-hour make-your-own magnetic sign places that were literally on every block in New York City in the early 80s.
That would be expensive. A rush job on a magnetic limousine decal, custom designed for your name with graphic design branding logo. That's expensive.
And
he's on a loss on this business for the first few weeks.
And a big comedy prop hat to fit over the siren on top of the hearse.
Had, yes.
Because what good is the sign without the big comedy hat?
It's so weird. I'll try harder to enjoy it. I'll try. I will.
Because invariably, that's what leads to enjoyment, is trying harder.
I'll concentrate.
Yet another day. I won't say it's the next day, because apparently the timeline of this movie is problematic for you, but let's say it's another day at the morgue. Bill enters babbling about his trip to Atlantic City. He got barred from the casino because he threw a drink at a pit boss. It all comes to a head, and Chuck tells him to shut up. Bill is wounded, and he goes off to lie down in a morgue drawer, as you do. Chuck immediately feels bad. He feels remorseful, goes over, pulls out the drawer, apologizes. And I maintain that this is a nice little bonding moment between the two.
It is. It's true. It is. Although, you know, it would have, I mean, he could have just slapped a padlock on that thing and had a nice calm, you know.
All through this movie, he keeps begging Bill to give him his old life back. He could have just slapped a padlock on the morgue drawer.
Yeah.
The next morning, Chuck heads home from the morgue. He sees Belinda in the elevator. She's been beat up because she doesn't have a pimp to protect her. He kneels down to try to help her. The elevator doors open. There's a crowd of tiny Girl Scouts outside. They misinterpret what's going on. They think he's the attacker. They attack him. and beat him insensible with boxes of cookies.
Yes.
Not a bad gag.
It's a good gag. I respect the attempt that this film is making to redefine pimps as being a good thing. Oh, she got beaten up because she doesn't have a pimp. That's not really how it usually works. It's usually the pimp that does the... And, you know, I mean, I hate to be that guy, but instead of two schmucks becoming pimps out of a city morgue, maybe just campaign for legalization of sex work.
Right, because that would be hilarious.
Hey, I'm not here to be hilarious.
Oh, I know, I've seen your act.
Thank you very much. Wait a minute.
And now we're turning on each other. It's the part of the podcast where we turn on each other like rats in a sack.
Rats in a sack. I'm sure you've done the research. You know the little cameo from a young star here.
I do.
The chief Girl Scout, Shannon Doherty from Beverly Hills 90210.
Or, as I have in my notes, one of the Girl Scouts is Shannon Doherty. She's the bitchy one. Moving on. So they end up in Belinda's apartment where he is helping her to recover from this, and he asks her why she doesn't just quit. Now, I think this is one of the most skillfully real moments actually in the whole movie. She gets her back up at this and asks him to leave. When he states the thing like it's simple, she justifiably loses her temper at him and by proxy at all the people who think she went into sex work because sex work is easy. I think that this was a carefully conceived and well-played moment.
Yes, I don't disagree. I give you that.
So she tells Chuck to get lost, and he does. On the subway the next night, or thereabouts, timeline, Chuck tells Bill about Belinda being beat up, and Bill, because he's an idea man, has a brainstorm. They have cars, they have quiet, they have free time. They could manage all the girls right out of the morgue.
Yeah, this is the stupidest idea in the history of ideas. Even though what, are you telling me that only smart things happen?
I did go back and read the New York Times piece from 1976. Clearly, these were not rocket scientists,
right.
These guys.
Yes.
Yeah. Chuck just waves it off. Bill is crazy. He has lots of crazy ideas all the time. Bill gets off at his stop, yells at Chuck through the window to think about it. It's a great idea. The train pulls away, and there is, I think, a great gag here where a blind saxophone player comes onto the train. And he stands right in front of Chuck and he starts playing. And Chuck gives him some coins. The guy hears the sound of the coins hitting his cup and immediately switches to angry, discordant, dissonant free jazz. And Chuck writes him a check.
Yes.
Yes. The sax player harasses Chuck with free jazz.
According to Henry Winkler, Michael Keaton gave him that gag to write him a check.
Well, there you go.
He was going to... put the coins in, and then as the guy sort of doesn't leave, he was going to just put his whole wallet in. And Keaton just said, hey, no, write him a check. Much funnier.
He punched up the gag.
Yeah.
At the blind man's expense. So I hope they felt good about that one. Chuck arrives home. There's a knock at the door. It's Belinda in her bathrobe. She feels bad about their last meeting. Can she make him breakfast? And he agrees, although he's a little flustered at having this cute girl in his apartment in a bathrobe. It's hot in the kitchen. She sheds her bathrobe to make breakfast, and he gets even more flustered. Yes, they concoct an excuse to have Shelley Long in her tiny underwear, but it's motivated, Matt.
Absolutely, and hopefully it will distract us from the fact that she says, what eggs would you like? And he says, scrambled, and she makes fried eggs. You can clearly see fried eggs in the pan until a couple of cuts later, she pours them onto the plate, and it's scrambled eggs. I mean, come on!
It's a little thing called continuity, people.
And where was the milk? You want a little milk in scrambled eggs.
Are you done? You feel better?
I am done. I don't feel better.
Okay. That night on the way into work, Bill and Chuck pick up sandwiches. Chuck's sandwich is wrong again. He can't get the right sandwich, this guy. Ooh, sandwiches. On their way to work, they're walking through Times Square, and Bill is trying to talk Chuck into the idea, and Chuck resists.
And they pause and have their conversation in front of a banner for a porn movie, which is called A Midsummer Night's Wet Dream, which is not a real porn movie, I checked. And it's quite a nice gag. But is it the best Shakespeare porn movie gag they could have tried?
I'm going to guess that you're planning to suggest it's not?
Perhaps instead of A Midsummer Night's Wet Dream, we could have had Julia sees her. Two gentlemen of Albona, Coriol's anus. Come on, that's a good one. King Rhea. Yeah. Titus Andronicus. Measure for Pleasure. Balls Well That Ends Well. Henry the Fourth's Part. Henry the Fourth's Part 2. Much Ado About My Thing. McButt. As You Like It. Thank you very much.
It's okay. I'm just going to cut that part. You should have stopped after Balls Well That Ends Well.
Balls
you
Well That Ends Well is pretty good.
Anyway, Chuck still resists. Bill gets disgusted and exits, calling back angrily.
I'm fed up, man. I'm fed up with you. I wash my hands and my feet of you.
Made me laugh.
Yeah.
We now go directly to the terrible Thanksgiving dinner sequence. The terrible Thanksgiving dinner with Chuck's mom and with Charlotte and her awful, humorless parents who are in from out of town. The phone rings. It's Belinda. She's been arrested. Because Franklin is dead, she has no one to bail her out. She needs Chuck's help.
So Chuck goes down to help her.
Yes.
With everybody and takes everybody with him.
Yeah. I have in my notes, I will read directly from my notes. Okay, this is a buy, and then in all cap letters, Matt. It's a buy. It is. It's a buy.
Okay, fine.
They cover it paper thin with Charlotte's father saying, well, we had to rent a car. They charged us an arm and a leg. Might as well use it. But yeah, it's bullshit. Of course it's bullshit. They get finished at night court. They're driving home. The other four talk about Chuck like he isn't even there. He's a child. He's helpless. They'll straighten him out. And the last straw, inciting incident, Matt, here it comes. The last straw is when his mother says, you know, his father was just like this too. He was a dreamer. He could have done anything he wanted with his life. But don't you worry, when they're married, we'll straighten Chuck out like I straightened out his father. Long, slow push in on Chuck's face. That's it. He's had enough.
I have here in my notes, in all caps, this film is so stressful.
Oh. It's that's sad.
It's
Chuck goes to see Bill. He's in. We cut to a scene in which Chuck and Bill's wearing a sharkskin suit and big shades, make a presentation to the call girls. I would say, you might say something different, but I would say this is a nice little parody of business presentations, of Chalk Talks. Would you agree?
Yep.
Really? All the fight's gone out of you?
No. Batman has, I forget the character's name, it's Batman on the Fonz. He's got a blackboard.
There's a nice little bit which feels like it might have come from Keaton as well, in which he breaks down and diagrams the word prostitution.
What's the essence what we're talking about? I'll spell it out for you if I have to. Prostitution. You know, a lot of times it'll help you to understand a word if you break it down, so let's do that now, shall we? Pros doesn't mean anything. Forget about that. Tit, I think we all know what that means. Two. Okay, two. Tit. And shun, of course, from the Latin to shun. Say no, huh? Thank you anyway, I don't want it. To push away. Doesn't even belong in this word, really. So let's get rid of that.
The girls are skeptical. Belinda urges Chuck to explain it to them like he explained it to her. He says he can put them on a business footing. They won't be abused. They'll get to keep 90% of their money. They'll have a dental plan. They'll have a medical plan. The girls are in. And this sets us up, Matt, for montage time. It's montage time.
It's montage time.
Got to have a montage, baby. They're running the business out of the morgue, and they are raking in the dough. But the work is killing Chuck. He's stressed again. Bill is flying high, but Chuck can't stand it. It's just like being a financial advisor all over again. This is not what he signed up for.
We get footage of the Fonz being a business genius on an old computer using, I think you'll find it's VisiCalc, and doing all his magical, genius, financial wizardry stuff. But they just took a smaller cut, so that's why the girls are making more money. There's no financial wizardry there. You don't need VisiCalc to be taking less money from a sex worker.
Well, VisiCalc did not take into account the long-term gains, which were still to come.
Right.
Ha 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 ha. Yeah. I will defend this movie to my last breath, which feels like it's coming up very soon.
It really made me laugh. It's all going fine. It's all going good, except the Fonz is stressed.
Correct. Another night in the morgue, Chuck arrives to find a frat party in progress, a wild, bacchanalian frat party. Yes, okay, this is the obligatory scene where there are topless girls running around. And there's a fun little cameo in this one, although it wasn't, strictly speaking, a cameo because at this point the guy was a nobody. Did you notice?
I did not notice. I read about it later and I thought to myself, oh, shall I go back and look at that? And then I thought, no.
As frat boy number one, ladies and gentlemen,
Kevin Costner of Waterworld.
That's right. Next, we have a nice little bridge scene between Chuck and Belinda. And again, a point of personal privilege here. As a person who was living blocks from where this scene was filmed in 1982, they come out of the late, very much lamented H&H Bagels, the best bagels in New York City. This was a little glimpse of the Upper West Side of the early 80s. It's a nice moment. And basically the point of the scene, to the degree that there is one, is that Chuck and Belinda are bonding. They're forming a friendship. Nice little scene.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Immediately followed by an absolutely preposterous scene in which Chuck and Bill are speeding down the FDR Drive in Bill's ridiculous pimpmobile, vanity license plates, I'm cool.
It's nice, huh? Nice. Practically drives itself, Chuck.
There is a good gag in this sequence where they're driving and Batman is talking up the car. It's got this, it's got that. And he says, oh, you can pop the trunk right from here. And he pops the trunk and it just cuts to a long shot of the trunk opening and tons of shit just coming out onto the road. That's funny.
You're laughing, Matt.
That's a funny gag.
Matt, it's so good to hear you laughing again. I honestly thought you might never recover.
Our long period of national mourning is over.
A quick scene, a meeting of Chuck and the ladies and Bill at Burger Steak, a burger chain which the ladies now own. Chuck and Bill have bought a controlling interest in this Burger Steak for the girls.
What the hell is this? So it's made very clear that Batman and the Fonz have not invested their own money in this because we see what they're doing with them. They've invested the girls' money in a steak of a burger joint without asking them, which seems deeply unethical and illegal.
You're thinking about illegality and this is what hangs you up?
Look, I know. My problem with this film is that I'm being rational and maybe it's my autistic brain, you know, being all rational. And if that's the case, then if you disagree, it's a hate crime. But it just seems really, it's like a dumb boyfriend doing a huge gesture. Look, I bought you this.
It's only about 40 seconds long. That's a lot of confusion to pack in 40 seconds.
I can get confused real quick.
Okay.
It's true. You'd be amazed.
Less so all the time. We check back in with the killer pimps just to remind you that that story is still out there.
Oh, yeah.
Next, it's Christmas time. We know this because there were Christmas trees on the street, 80th and Broadway, when they were coming out of H&H Bagels. Oh, H&H Bagels. You would walk in there and it smelled so good. The air was steamy and doughy. Mm. Oh, it was fabulous. It's a Christmas party for the ladies in the morgue. Chuck, Bill, and Belinda in a nice beat after the party. And it's a real moment again where Bill talks about his terrible father and what living with him did to his mother. Keaton plays it straight, and it's quite nice. The guy is clearly damaged goods. Mm-hmm. And then he shakes it off, and he says he's going to teach Chuck how to live. What's Chuck spending all his money on anyway? And Chuck says, in a way that suggests a hard cut, you want to see what I've been spending my money on? And we next see them pulling into a cemetery where Chuck has bought the biggest headstone in the place for his late father, who was essentially bullied to death by his dragon of a mother. And Belinda clocks this.
Again? What the hell is going on here?
He does it to properly memorialize his father, who was bullied to death by his overbearing mother and unappreciated in life.
Why didn't he buy his dead dad a share in a burger joint like he must have always wanted? I mean,
The point of this, I think, is that Belinda is moved by this. So much so that in the next scene back in Belinda's apartment, I have written, as I seem to write at some point inevitably in my notes for all of these movies, it is so on now. It's on between Chuck and Belinda. And then there is a nice scene of afterglow in which Chuck is worried that Belinda was faking because she is, after all, a professional prostitute. She assures him that she wasn't.
Which is exactly what a professional prostitute would say.
Again, fair. The next evening, showing up at work, Chuck is over the moon. Bill is frazzled. Where have you been? We got stiffs coming in. We got girls going out. Belinda arrives. Chuck is knocked back a little bit by it. And we learn very quickly that she's back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck can't believe it. He thought for sure she'd quit now. But again, she's more clear-headed than he is. Okay, so say she quits. What's she going to do? And things escalate. They lash out at each other. And she goes off to the trick.
I have here in my notes, the Fonz has slept with Diane Chambers and is then shocked when she still wants to make her own life choices after she saw his penis. Then I have a new line and then it says, women, huh?
Yeah.
And then I have, all the main characters in this movie need therapy except Shelley Long. She seems fine.
Bill drives Belinda to the call. She is distraught. She doesn't want to go. Bill tells her it's okay, drives her home. I maintain that this is sweet and touching because I'm not a cynical, emotionless monster.
How very dare you?
Right. Probably cut that part. Here's the thing I will say. We're headed for the barn here, and not a moment too soon. The last act of this movie kind of goes off the rails a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
Yeah. The killer pimps show up at the morgue. They start beating Chuck up, and in a way that's a little distressing for a comedy, they begin to literally torture him. It involves a fire hose and a switchblade. Comedy gold, always.
Yeah, they torture the Fonz by putting a fire hose in his mouth and turning it on. Do morgues have fire hoses?
Yes.
Or did they feed it in through a window?
Morgues have to have fire hoses. Sometimes you get a really bad corpse fire.
Yeah. No, fair. Fair.
So Bill is having a drink at a club where he makes contact with two Johns who he does not know are actually undercover cops. He brings the cops to the morgue. They discover the quite distressing fire hose torture in progress. There's a shootout. The killer pimps get busted. Yay! But so, unfortunately, do Chuck and Bill. Busted.
Yay!
Not a moment too soon for Matt.
Boo.
They're in the holding cell and Charlotte arrives. It's a fake out. You think she's there to bail him out, but she breaks up with him. She is, justifiably, angry with him, spits on him through the bars. And Bill says, indignantly,
"And after you were deloused."
Oh, boy.
In the holding cell, by the way, I will note that it is the first time, the first of three times that are coming up in the 15 minutes or so that are left in this movie, although it will feel like long to Matt. It's the first of three times that Chuck tells Bill, "I want my old life back." We'll come back to that. The girls arrive to bail them out. Where's Belinda? No Belinda. We next go to a positively preposterous scene in the lawyer's office, where the lawyer tells them that because it's an election year, the administration wants to avoid any publicity, so there will be no charges. There will be no charges pressed for this obviously outrageously heinous crime wave. I say in my notes, and I have highlighted it so I would not miss it, okay, so yeah, this is kind of bullshit.
Yes.
Bill wants to press their advantage, but Chuck, for the second time, tells him he just wants his old life back. They get into a huge fight. It's over between them. It's Splitsville. The partnership is kaput.
Yeah, I mean, the Fonz should have killed Batman a long time ago.
They have names, Matt.
Oh, like Bruce Wayne. Right. Don't tell anyone, though. Arthur Fonzarelli.
Thank you. So Chuck arrives back at home and runs into Belinda. They are, as you may remember, neighbors. She's moving out. She has a new job at a club called Paradise Found. They can't forgive each other, and she goes. Sandwich guy, played by character actor Vincent Schiavelli, shows up. One of those guys. You know him if you see him. Sandwich guy shows up with the wrong order. He's belligerent. He's an asshole because, remember, New York in 1982 was a comedy hellscape. Chuck snaps. It's the last straw slash sandwich, Matt.
Yeah.
He won't be a victim anymore.
He has suddenly become magically assertive and confident.
Yes.
I think the film wanted me to know why, but I don't think I know why. What was the event that made him suddenly become, you know, all that he could be? I don't get it.
Seeing Belinda?
Yeah.
Okay, it wasn't entirely earned.
It was weird. It felt, for me, it felt like there was something missing that was the moment, the instigating thing that made him, you know?
Yeah, yep. They do pay off the dog bit, though. The dog charges him, and he stops it in his tracks with a commanding glare.
Yeah.
Tells the dog to go home, and the dog does, because apparently it's one of those dogs that understands English.
Yeah.
Last sequence, Matt.
He goes into a diner, and he hits a jukebox, and it just starts up. And no, that's not. That doesn't
Wait a
happen.
Second. Chuck striding through the rain-wet streets of Manhattan, a new man. This is the kind of sequence that in a later generation of rom-coms would take place in an airport concourse. It's the romantic lead realizing he's made a terrible mistake and he has to go undo this mistake. He goes striding into Paradise Found to look for Belinda. And it's this weird tropical nightmare of a place with fake volcanoes and steam coming out of them. It looks like the set that they had the Bad Muppets on in the first season of Saturday Night Live. He meets the manager, played by character actor Joe Spinell. Joe Spinell played Willie Cheechy in Godfather 2. Bill is there as the towel boy, wearing a leopard skin sarong for some reason. I'm not entirely sure why. They meet. Chuck says, "I want my old life back." And Bill says,
"Sure, you're not telling me three times, pal. I'm out."
Oh. Oh, pretty good.
It's all subtext.
Yeah.
So somebody was paying attention. Belinda arrives to start work. A preppy jerk accosts her. She rebuffs him. Chuck rushes in to defend her. He gets socked in the face. Bill comes to his defense. Okay, this is kind of a mess. Chuck finally confesses to Belinda that he loves her. Then he tells Bill that Bill finally succeeded in making a man out of him. He shoves Joe Spinell into the pool. They flee the club. They're buddies again. Yay! There's a long, slow pullback to aerial shots of New York City, and the closing credits roll over Rod Stewart's That's What Friends Are For, which is a little weird. Because I guess what friends are for is to bust you out of a sex club?
This, and please pardon my French, fucking song. Mm. In the second half of this film, it plays in every other scene of the film. And
it's a motif.
Oh, it's not good. So I have here in my notes about the finale of this film.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I'm really sorry. I'm going to be grumpy guy again.
Live your truth.
Well, so I've got... So they all live happily ever after. The two guys get their jobs back and, oh, wait, Shelley Long now has nothing except a boyfriend. She left her job, I guess. The boys aren't being pimps anymore, so all of her friends have been betrayed and left out in the cold, so presumably go back to being exploited for 90% of their earnings again. So, yay. The Fonz's girlfriend, mental health, now will spiral as her betrayal by the Fonz confirms what her depression has been telling her all these years about her worthlessness. Brilliant.
So it was a kitchen sink drama to you?
It was a study of coke-fueled toxic masculinity.
You know, Matt, we've known each other for a few years now.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I have ever heard you sigh quite so much.
To be fair, sighs do come easily to me.
So, as we wave goodbye to Batman and the Fonz, as they disappear into our rearview mirror, it falls to me to ask, how'd I do?
I wanted to like this film. I really wanted to like it, but I think I found the idea of it not great. But it was the Michael Keaton character. I just, as soon as he came through the door and started his first bit, I was like, oh God, oh, he's doing that. This is what it's going to be. It's going to be this coked up, hey, wacky, wacky, wacky. And that just unbalanced it for me. And I feel really bad because I know you like this film.
I do. I don't think this is a great film. I think it was a nice little mid-budget big studio comedy that did a few things for a few people involved. It almost certainly got Ron Howard the directing work that he would continue to do for the rest of his life. It gave Henry Winkler a chance to make a big, deliberate step away from the character of the Fonz.
Hmm.
And for Michael Keaton, who I enjoyed a lot more than you did in this, it, to me, announced the presence on the scene of a major new talent. I found it less unpalatable than you did. Some of that for me is probably tied up with having lived in New York in the early 80s and a little nostalgia, you know, none of which excuses the things about it that are a little unseemly, but none of those really ruined it for me. So I think if I had to sum it all up, I think this one's a draw. I'm going to call this one a draw.
I think I would have liked it much more had I seen it when it had first came out or closer to the date when it came out. As you say, you have a connection to New York, but I think also you saw it when it came out, when it was of its time, and I'm seeing it when it's out of its time. And I think that's a hard thing to sort of escape from, that perspective.
So there we are, a tie, more or less. We'll be back soon with a whole new season, our fourth season of Imagination and Junk, the transatlantic conversation about the hard work of creativity. Thanks for playing our little game, and and see you in hell.
Bye-bye now.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.
I feel so bad about it, about not liking it. I genuinely do.